Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I had the pleasure to sit down with Alexandra Chandler. She is an openly trans woman running for Congress out of Massachusetts's 3rd District. That is a tongue twister. We had a wonderful conversation about national security, nuclear weapons proliferation, and how her personal experiences with coming out as trans make her a strong candidate.
I have Trump voters come up to me and say they will vote for me in this primary simply because I can look them in the eye and say, when you tell me about your struggles, I struggled too.
But before we get to that, I want to do a little bit of listener feedback and announce the Hellion of the Week. And I also want to talk about violent white men again. And it saddens me that I have to talk about this again. I feel like I just talked about it after the Parkland school shooting. But there was another school shooting in Baltimore, Maryland yesterday. And that story is largely being obscured by other news stories, and also the narrative has kind of gotten away from what really needs to be discussed there. And then, of course, the Austin, Texas bomber, another white man, and the connections there. But first, let's jump into some feedback. First, we have at Gorgophone, who said, quote, "I am concerned about a presidential affair since it makes the commander-in-chief blackmailable. I don't care about how a person runs their sex life outside of abusive behavior, but it presents a vulnerability that can be used to exploit." And I think this is a really good point, and this is a really interesting point, and also speaks to the reason why we have security clearance background checks. A lot of people think it's, you know, they go around and see if you're a good person of good character to get a security clearance, but that's not necessarily the case. What they're really looking for are vulnerabilities and ways that you could be exploited, things from your life, your personal life, your past professional life, and if that could be then used to leverage you to get top secret sensitive information. So that, you know, that is why I believe Jared Kushner doesn't have a top secret security clearance. I don't think anyone is sitting there saying, oh no, Jared Kushner's not a good guy. I think that he has significant financial areas that could be exploited by a bad actor. So I think in the case of Donald Trump, though, we've talked about the salacious claims in the Steele dossier, aka the P tapes. And I think that is a blackmailable point. And I think to that end that it's considered, you know, quote, compromise if they actually have something like that on Donald Trump. But I think specifically with the Stormy Daniels case, which is what I believe at Gorgophone is referring to, for that affair to be a blackmailable issue, it would have to be something that the president doesn't want to get out at any cost. And since in this case, he has already admitted that he is David Dennison, the pseudonym used in the NDA, I think everyone now knows that he had this affair, and therefore it's not really a blackmailable piece of information anymore since it's basically already known. But it is a really good point. Affairs and financial issues and all of that is definitely a concern about blackmail. I still don't care who the president fucks, as long as it can't be used against him, but for national security purposes, which in this case, I really don't think it could be. I don't think he has enough shame for that. Then I really don't care. But I do care about violating election finance laws and, you know, paying off people with campaign money. So next we have Jay from Twitter. They said, quote, "The comment about waiting for boomers to die is not only insulting, it's also lazy. How many millennials declined to vote in the 2016 election? Other than that, love the podcast." Well, thank you for listening and thank you for loving the podcast. And as for the comment we made on Monday about boomers dying, what I got from that conversation when Drexel and I were saying was that we're not waiting for boomers to die, but as the generational shifts occur, as millennials grow up and get older, and as some of the older folks start to leave the voting pool for whatever reason, death, age, whatever, the demographics of the electorate are going to shift, and they're going to shift in ways that we can predict and ways that we can't predict. So I think that's what we were really more getting at, was some of these ideas and ideology that have been largely associated with the boomers will eventually start to transform as the electorate demographic shifts. But it is a good point. It was not a very nice thing to say. I would rather change boomers' minds than have them die off. Before I get to Hellion of the Week, I'm going to talk about violent white men. First, I want to talk about the Maryland school shooting that happened yesterday. I'm recording this on Wednesday night, so this was Tuesday. A 17-year-old gunman, whose name I will not say, at around 8 o'clock in the morning, went to the school and shot a 16-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy. The 16-year-old girl has life-threatening injuries, and the 14-year-old boy seems to be doing just fine. What's interesting about this story is the way the media has framed it. Really, what they're focusing on is the fact that there was a resources officer on campus that stopped the shooting in under a minute. And that's really the story that all of the major news outlets are running with. What no one seems to be talking about is the fact that the female victim was in a prior relationship with the gunman. And we don't really know much about that relationship or what that was like. Partly, I mean, they're teenagers. Partly because the gunman was killed at some point after the shooting occurred, and this female victim is still in the hospital. But it also just seems like nobody really cares. I know it's very uncomfortable to talk about intimate partner violence and domestic violence in general, and especially when we're talking about teenagers, but it happens. And, you know, in the wake of Parkland, which was on Valentine's Day, which was perpetrated by a gunman who had a grudge against his ex-girlfriend, it just seems so glaringly obvious that this is what we need to focus on. And it took me 3 Google searches to find any mention of this prior relationship. And then in one article, I found one sentence. And it was in CBS, and it was very much buried. And so my issue with the way this is being reported is really summed up by the CNN headline, which was, quote, "Maryland school officer stops armed student who shot 2 others." If we go back to English class, we can diagram that sentence a little bit. But basically, the subject of that sentence is the Maryland school officer, and the basically object were the 2 victims. And I think that type of reporting, it really, first of all, plays in and propagates Trump's calls to, quote, arm teachers and school staff. And it makes it seem like, oh, well, obviously armed people on campus can stop school shootings, which is not the right thing to take away from this. The idea that a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun to reduce it is such a load of crap that these sort of stories where they're framing this as a, quote, good guy with a gun stopping a horrific tragedy is really irresponsible. You know, I'm happy that this didn't elevate into a larger tragedy, and I'm happy that this resource officer was there. But we can't assume that that's always going to be the case, especially when you're talking about arming teachers who nobody knows their level of training or what that training would look like or if they're going to be paid more. And just the presence of more firearms on a school campus is not going to lead to fewer school shootings, period. That's not how this works. That's just not logical. So in addition to this domestic violence and intimate partner violence angle being overlooked, it's also really propagating this dangerous idea that arming people in schools is going to somehow prevent school shootings or prevent them from becoming bigger tragedies than they already are, which is just the wrong tack to take. You know, also, the way they've described this gunman, you know, there were quotes like, quote, "he was a good kid from a nice family." And again, the fact that he is a young white male has really created this cushy narrative for the media to follow that says that he was just a troubled kid or this quote unquote lone wolf who did something bad. And that's just not how this is. And that segues nicely into the next thing I want to talk about, which is the Austin, Texas bomber, who is a 23-year-old white male who was, I believe, being pursued by the police this morning and detonated a bomb and killed himself. And this is also a classic case of an angry white, I mean, he was 23, but an angry white kid with, you know, very deeply held conservative misogynist viewpoints, basically creating terror in a city. And the fact that the media isn't calling this terrorism directly just speaks so much to how the media and this country frames violence when it's perpetrated by white men. You know, I really loved fellow Hellion Julie at Resisterhood who tweeted about this. She tweeted about this BuzzFeed article talking about what we knew about this bomber. And a lot of what they talked about was how this guy was very conservative, who ran a conservative blog when he blogged about being anti-same-sex marriage, anti-sex offender registration, pro-death penalty. I mean, these very overtly violent sort of ideologies. And you know, he just gets this sort of fluffy New York Times profile in which the narrative becomes about how he was a, quote, very intense person. He could sometimes get frustrated. And he was from a, quote, tight-knit, godly family. And I have to know, would the New York Times have published those quotes about a Muslim man or a black man or anyone except a young white man? And in this BuzzFeed article, we also learned some very disturbing things, such as he went to a summer camp where he learned to carry knives and shoot guns, but they couldn't remember if they had been teaching bomb making or bombs being a specific topic covered at this camp. So the fact that we know all of this, this is a very much radicalization narrative, you know, someone, especially when you're talking about someone like a Muslim person, you would say, oh, this person was radicalized and is working for some larger terrorist organization, whether or not that might be true. And here is a clear example of how someone can become radicalized. But since he's a white man, it's being framed as him just being a nerdy, bullied kid, a very intense person. So this perpetuating narrative about violence, gun violence, and this terroristic violence, because, you know, sending and detonating bombs is targeted, is a way to create mass fear. And it really did. I mean, Austin was in fear, and that is the definition of terrorism. And I have not seen one publication call this guy a terrorist. Because as I said, right after the Parkland school shooting, This isn't about one person, one time. This isn't about one school shooting or one person sending bombs to people. This is about a systemic failure of our society and the willful ignorance that we still have of who is dangerous and why. Because white men are the most likely group of people to commit acts of violence, particularly acts of violence against women. All right, since it is Thursday, I'm going to announce the Hellion of the Week. This week, I found a delightful story that has a very happy ending about a woman named Sheila Miner Huff. She is a 71-year-old retired grandma of five who likes to belly dance. That was one of my favorite details. But this all started when a woman had requested some documents because she wanted to write a children's book. And she got this photograph of 38 white men and one black woman who is partially obscured that from a biology conference in 1971. All of the men in the photograph were named, but she was listed as not identified. She posted this on Twitter and she really wanted to find out who this woman was. And through the magic of Twitter, we found out she had been working as a technician at the museum. And it's also interesting because this caught the attention of Margot Lee Shetterly, who is the author of Hidden Figures, The American Dream, and the untold story of the Black women mathematicians who helped win the space race, which the movie Hidden Figures is based off of. And she said, quote, here's a working scientist contributing alongside her colleagues, and she's not even given the professional courtesy of having her name recorded at a scientific conference. The photo with her brown face, half obscured by the people around her, is a perfect metaphor for the larger issue of history's failure to record the work of women scientists, particularly women scientists of color. So, and I think that's a really great point. And the fact of the matter is we don't even know how many women of color, people who were working in these sciences who were not identified in photographs because it didn't seem important. So Sheila Minor Huff was eventually tracked down on social media. And she is such a cool person. So she said that she began working as an animal technician shortly after graduating with a bachelor's degree in biology. And she applied for her first job at the Bureau of Sport, Fisheries, and Wildlife. And she was asked to be a typist. And she said, quote, no, I went to school too long to be your secretary. She then went on to complete a master's degree while working full time. She went to the Soviet Union to attend a conference for mammalogists, and she worked with top government officials on a range of wildlife and environmental projects. And by the time she retired at age 58, she had become a GS-14 federal employee, which is one of the highest designations possible at the Department of the Interior. And this is according to the New York Times, which it's a fabulous piece about her. And she is one of the women who throughout history has just worked quietly on the sidelines doing good work and not getting the credit they deserve. And so today here on Hellbent, Sheila Minor Huff, we recognize you for your fabulous contributions to this country. And the fact that you weren't recognized earlier is a disgrace. Our guest today is Alexandra Chandler, who is running for Congress out of Massachusetts's 3rd District. She is an openly trans woman who has a storied career in the intelligence community. We are so lucky to have her today. So welcome, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to talk to you. My first question that I always like to start with is, what prompted you to run for office?
As with many women candidates, I'll be honest and say a lot of arm twisting was certainly a part of it. But for me, it was a realization following a lot of arm twisting that I was the best possible candidate for our congressional race to actually get things done in Washington for working class and middle class people.
Yeah.
And the reasons why in my case were my experience in the intelligence community where I worked for 13 years tackling tough problems, the fact that national security experience was something that no one else in the race had and is needed right now, experience in community health care, and my lived experience as a working middle-class mom and experience with issues like daycare costs and student loans, all that added together, lots of arm twisting, and now I'm in it.
Right. Yeah, daycare is no joke.
Yes. We moved from Washington, D.C. with the highest daycare costs in the country to Massachusetts with the second highest daycare costs in the country. So
what a deal.
I don't know what that says about me.
Right.
Maybe it's my fault.
Well, I really love that you say like you are the most qualified for this job. I feel like a lot of women have a hard time admitting that and saying I'm running because I'm qualified. And I really love that. I also really liked right on your website under issues and you're talking about equality, you state unequivocally that you support a feminist agenda. And I don't think I've ever seen that written out on another candidate's platform.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think I have. Huh. It just the feminist agenda. So what is a feminist agenda to you?
So first, I'm proud and sad.
Yeah.
What you just said.
Yeah.
Because I think there'd be many more. But I mean, for me, it's that it's not just enough to say that we're supportive of equality for women,
right,
but then to flesh that out in perspective of the multiple identities that women bring, mm-hmm. that sometimes we lose in just that big headline moment, that it's not just the fact that we are women, but we are women with different races, different classes, different sexual orientations and gender identities. And we have to address all of that together to properly advance what I see as a feminist agenda. So what that means in terms of concrete policies, that's equal pay, that's reproductive rights, that is education, that is equity right. as well. Because when it comes to things like paid family leave, I certainly support the idea that parental leave and family leave should be equal for people who identify as male and female. But what I also note is that we do, as a society, put increased burdens and expectations on women. So there's a certain urgency about it for women because those burdens often fall more directly upon us.
Right, right. And I feel like there's also more judgment a lot of times with the choices that women make, especially when it comes to family and reproductive rights and that sort of thing.
I have an anecdote to tell on that. Yeah. I was just at a town hall / presentation about my congressional run last night. And I had a woman come up to me afterwards, a very liberal, progressive woman, supportive of my run, who very seriously, and I could tell it was heartfelt, asked, you know, the only thing I worry about you with this run is, well, what will happen to your family?
Right.
You know, and it's like, I then answered that, well, I do have, I'm very fortunate to have a wonderful wife as a partner. Right. I also have my parents right here and all that. But it was that, how many men get asked that question?
Literally zero.
In terms of choosing to, right, exactly, choosing to run. So it's just, it's in every circle
right.
that you get this. Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely, definitely. There is this perception that women are giving up more by taking on something mm-hmm. like a congressional run.
Yes.
So I like to ask female candidates, because I feel like this is something that doesn't get talked a lot about, but have you experienced sexism, misogyny, and in your case, something like transphobia openly on the campaign trail?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
It ranges from very direct to subtle. I mean, there's the fair share of, you know, being called honey this or whatever variation thereof from senior members right. of the party establishment, that sort of thing. And then less subtle things just in terms of people trying to talk over you, that sort of thing, oh, yeah. and that it's disproportionately men doing it to mostly women, myself and other women candidates in the race. Fortunately, having worked for 13 years for the U.S. military, I have some experience in male-dominated
right.
realms and just powering past and through that. So it's a challenge, but it's a challenge I've been fortunately able to surmount.
Yeah, it's if no one ever calls me sweetheart ever again, it'll be too.
Exactly. Seriously. Yeah.
And, you know, were you worried about running as an openly trans woman, a woman who has a wife, obviously in this LGBTQ community? Were you worried that that would affect how your constituents see you?
I was worried. Mm-hmm. But I also had a level of optimism from my own story, because I transitioned gender while on the job at the Office of Naval Intelligence in 2006
right.
while working North Korean WMD proliferation issues. And I had a very conservative chain of command and conservative leadership that could have fired me on the spot,
right.
but stood with me. So that's told me that, you know, sometimes your expectations of how you might be met by the public, for instance, can be skewed by the angry and terrible voices on TV.
Right.
Now that said, particularly as a woman in politics, you tend to attract those terrible, terrible voices and the trolls. But I worried a bit. We worried a bit about harassment and all of that. But I have to say, the messages, emails, comments have been well over 100-1 in favor.
That's great.
Not counting anonymous comments on news websites, but everyone knows, never read those.
Don't read the comment section.
No. And it's been that way now for 5 months of campaigning.
Yeah.
It's been, and that in and of itself has been something I like to tell people as women, as LGBT people, as trans people in particular, come up to me and talk about being interested in politics. Right. And like saying, well, I can't imagine what you're facing out there.
Right.
And I say, well, I face a little bit, but mostly people are better than you might think.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that, especially because in these highly partisan and somewhat mean times. That's actually really lovely to hear. So what do you think is your biggest strength as a candidate?
It really goes to my intelligence community experience, right? Because on one hand, that's both about expertise, that I am a Russian-speaking lawyer.
Right.
I am a former intelligence analyst.
Right.
There are certain skills resident within that and knowledge that we could really use in Congress as a check on the recklessness of the administration and the challenges in foreign policy. I think that Congress has not been able to fulfill its constitutional role. I can help them do that. But then the strength that experience in the intel world also brings is I've had to work across government in the Bush administration, the Obama administration, briefly the Trump administration. I have led an intelligence delegation abroad, including in the Middle East.
Wow.
I can work with people that are not at all like me and find common ground.
Right.
So, and I've a long record in doing that. So what then, coupled with a very progressive agenda where I go bold and say, yes, we will go directly for Medicare for All, and here's the roadmap to get there.
Right.
Yes, we're going to go back to progressive taxation, the likes of which we haven't seen since 1982, and here's how we'll get there. That we start with these big, bold goals, and then I can work pragmatically to get us one step at a time to those goals.
Right.
I think that is somewhere where I'm uniquely positioned. And the fact that I am a transgender woman.
Right.
I bring multiple layers of identities that are just so underrepresented in Congress,
right?
And that I see more people. I have Trump voters come up to me and say they will vote for me in this primary simply because I can look them in the eye and say, when you tell me about your struggles, I've struggled too,
right?
And I will always remember that struggle when I'm there. I had a dad that struggled with addiction, mm-hmm. and the opioid epidemic is a huge problem. Actually, President Trump just the other day demonized one of our communities here, the city of Lawrence. And I recorded a video just staring at the camera, telling him off about it, because that's the extent of the problem around here. I've had to live that impact on a family. So again, lived experience that I can bring to Congress and the actual ability to move the ball forward and get things done.
Right. You know, I've been reading a lot of pieces about Democratic messaging and like you said, you have these very progressive ideas and a very pragmatic approach. But what do you say to the people within the party who want to slow walk the more progressive ideology?
I say that it's not what the people want.
Yeah.
That if you go out there and you say, what about going back to big investments in education and infrastructure that brought us the greatest middle class the world has ever seen in the 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, there are terrible issues in terms of racial inequality,
right,
and inequality between the genders and all of that. But in terms of economic opportunity, that's what people want.
Right.
They want a higher minimum wage, strong unions, all of it.
Right.
So why would we slow walk that?
Yeah.
Run with it.
Right.
Run with it. Because it's when I do that and when I talk about that, that I'm getting the Trump voters and others that are the kind of the vote that we're supposed to be chasing now because of what we've been doing wrong,
right,
as some would say, in messaging. You can do that and live and be very authentic in terms of there's often that pushback of, well, you know, don't give in to identity politics and all of that. I am very openly and authentically out there as being a trans lesbian woman.
Right.
And I'm saying all this and I'm gaining support. So I push back on that narrative of slow walk, be incremental. No,
right.
Be big,
right.
Be bold.
Right. I also want to talk a little bit about your time in the intelligence community, because you worked to prevent the spread of new weapons of mass destruction in countries like North Korea and Iran. So what are your thoughts? And this is just, I'm extremely interested to know, what are your thoughts on Trump's approach to the Iran deal and talks with North Korea leadership in general? And I know that's a huge compound question, but maybe start with this, the Iran deal, and what your thoughts on that are.
It's extremely dangerous what he's doing, because in working to undermine the Iran deal, which a deal that brings together countries as diverse as Iran, China, Russia, the United States, and Europe, European powers, something good is probably happening there.
Right.
And it was carefully negotiated for a reason. By working to undermine it, there's cascading problems that come from this. First, it adds to the narrative that the United States can't be trusted to hold up our end of serious diplomatic agreements, which then links to North Korea, because then if he's going to be meeting with Kim Jong-un, if you're Kim Jong-un and you see us tearing up the Iran deal before your eyes,
right,
why on earth will you agree to anything to resolve the conflict on the Korean Peninsula,
right,
or future issues we might find ourselves in? And this has an economic impact, because much as I very much want us to move to a renewable economy, the sooner the better, and that's detailed in my platform and all of it, there's nothing like raising the price of gasoline to $6 or $7 a gallon than conflict in the Middle East.
Right.
And that's what he's courting. And it doesn't make us more safe. It doesn't make our allies more safe. So I'm extremely concerned.
Why do you think he opposes it? As he does. This was something that he never talked about on the campaign. I mean, he didn't talk about much on the campaign trail, but to be honest, but where do you think this is coming from? Is this some sort of deeply held political belief? Again, you can't read his mind, or is this coming from somewhere else in this administration, a little more sinisterly?
Well, I think on the Iran deal, there's a certain amount of reflexive, well, it was Obama's deal, therefore I'm against it. I believe sometimes the explanation is very simple and human, and it's personal with him. And then there are those that are ideological that are opposed to it within the administration. And to be clear, I am not naive when it comes to Iran. They support terrorism in the region. They're a threat on multiple levels, and there are things that we can do to improve the deal without threatening it in any way. He is not doing that. I think that's what's driving him there. And then when it comes to North Korea, I think there's a certain amount of arrogance. I don't care that multiple administrations have had shared approaches on this, and there are certain things that worked and not worked. I'm different. I make deals. I make the best deals. So I'm going to talk to him, and I'm going to figure this out.
Right.
But that's not borne out by how well he's been doing with Putin so far. So I am extremely, extremely concerned. And that's where I think we need members of Congress that can really hold the administration to account, use the power of the person oversight to really yank him back where needed.
So do you think that the lack of oversight in Congress is because there are so many Trump-aligned Republicans in seats? Or do you think it's because they don't know what to do with him?
I think it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
I think that there are certainly those on the Democratic side who are doing great work. I mean, think of Adam Schiff on intelligence and others that are doing their best. There's just so much going wrong that it is a challenge. And then on the other side, I think that there are many Republicans who are afraid. I don't know if it's so much that they are Trump aligned explicitly, but they don't see a political cost to be paid right now in not taking that role seriously. I mean, I think that to a certain level too, this can only be marginally improved until at least the House, and hopefully the House and Senate are in Democratic hands, because there are committees that, even though they're under Republican control, like the Senate Intelligence Committee, that are largely doing the right thing and fulfilling their responsibilities. But then, say, on the House side, the HPSI, House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, it's just fallen completely down on partisan lines and is ineffective. So it's a combination of big, big political change that has to happen, but then more expertise, because then if you have people that are really eliciting answers that shock people out of their partisan stasis, that we could start to have some change.
Yeah. So what is your day one plan? What is the first thing you want to do when you get to Congress?
It's going to focus on pay and underemployment, really, because that's where I think that I can most likely forge some common ground with some Republicans in similarly situated districts.
Yeah.
My district in Massachusetts, it's not Boston and Cambridge. This is a very working, middle-class, mostly area of Massachusetts along the New Hampshire border. A lot of old mill towns where a lot of industry moved out. There are, you know, sparks of growth that are happening, but prosperity is uneven. And there are a lot of places where it's not even a matter that someone doesn't have a living wage. It's that they're cobbling two or three jobs together and they still don't have a living wage. And there are a lot of communities like that in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. So I'm going to push for an expansion of the earned income tax credit. Mm. I'm going to push for expanded federal support to apprenticeships. And I believe I can reach across the aisle and pick up some existing bills that are out there, or I will write or co-sponsor my own.
Right.
And I think that I have a decent shot of getting that down. The earned income tax credit expansion, that's been supported by Barack Obama and Paul Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about some diverse figures supporting it. We can make some change and movement there. And then the opioid epidemic, that's another one where it's just, there are so many that suffer here where you cannot talk to someone in a town hall where they haven't had a friend or a member of their family that has suffered, and in some cases very tragically so. Mm. So I've got an entire proposal in terms of focusing on the treatment end. There's a lot of focus, sadly, right now in Washington, including most of all from the president, on how we're going to punish people,
right?
How we're going to go after the drug dealers, the death penalty for them. But what we really need is the focus on this as a public health emergency. And one of my jobs in my past, I was a member of the board of directors of a not-for-profit community health center that had an entire day treatment arm and focused on HIV/AIDS care and LGBT health. And the opioid epidemic, it's a public health issue and needs to be treated as such, with all the not just health care and drug treatment, but the wraparound services, supportive housing, employment to help people in treatment and recovery, make that easier than going for the next fix.
Right.
That's what we need to do.
Right.
And I think I can make some progress.
Yeah. Yeah. And what is an issue that directly affects your district that doesn't get a lot of national media attention?
That doesn't get a lot of national media attention. Well, in the western part of our district, we have a number of farmers, particularly dairy farmers, that are struggling because of the collapse in the prices of milk, and that they struggle in competition against very large farmers that can have benefits of corporate subsidies that they will never get.
Right.
So that's something that I would like to make common cause with. Senator Gillibrand has talked about it a little bit, but it's not something that's exactly national news. A lot of the other issues, though, for our district are very much what you see in the national conversation. So I'd say education would be another one where you don't hear as much as you should, because even though this is Massachusetts and as a state, technically a commonwealth, we have one of the best educational systems in the country. The cost of college and at the elementary level, the fact that we have communities where people are paying for daycare, for kindergarten, where in a lot of the country, kindergarten is just, well, that's part of the primary education that you get as a taxpayer. But no.
Yeah.
Many communities, you have to pay for that.
Wow.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
We need more federal funding support for those communities, because that is just perpetuating income inequality and divisions and opportunity into the next generation.
Right.
We have to change that now.
You know, it's so interesting, because in speaking to so many female candidates, that is the number one response I get, is education and the educational system. And, you know, how there's less and less federal support for these programs.
Oh, so true. And I was a PTA vice president of Title I school that my son went to previously. And I've seen what it's like where year in, year out, it's like, well, how much Title I funds are you going to get? That'll mean whether aftercare costs this much or that much, or whether we'll be able to have this level of enrichment or not. Because if you don't get the funds there, then it has ripple effects in terms of what the system is able to do, not just for more vulnerable student populations, but for the population at large.
Right.
And again, not so much in the national conversation.
Right. Oddly enough. I mean, I feel like I talk about it all the time.
I'm shocked with Congress looking the way it is that issues that affect middle-class people that actually have their kids in the public school system wouldn't be part of the conversation.
I know. I mean, I personally, in my own head, Betsy DeVos is my personal arch nemesis. So for me, I'm always floored by the lack of debate on educational policy. And then I have one last question. What aspect of the current political landscape right now is most toxic for the American people from where you're sitting?
That we no longer assume best intent of one another. Mm. And this isn't some utopian thing, in that I'm not saying that the policies that many advance on the federal Republican side and conservative side don't have real terrible harm that they can do to working middle class people and vulnerable populations. But I assume that those people advancing them are wrong and misguided, and completely believe that they're doing the right thing for the people. I just think they're wrong and misguided. And I would like them to have the same belief in me in reverse. And I think far, far too few people are in that headspace. And I would like to become a part of a movement to restore that perspective into our politics. Because I think that then we can still have vigorous policy debates, but that it doesn't go into that toxic, reflexive, defensive realm so fast.
Right.
And I think that the debates will yield better policies that way.
And then, Alexandra, last but not least, we like to do a gratitude check. So we live in pretty dark political times. So what is something that gets you through the day?
Oh, goodness. You know, it might be a cliche and expected answer, but it's my kids. It is so my kids, because my two sons are 5 and 2, and it's just every day is some incredible exploration where my 5-year-old is asking questions, whether about dragons, or he's thinking that running for Congress means that I have to go to the gym and learn how to run really fast. And that then if I win the race, I get to tell Donald Trump about his bad choices. And then the 2-year-old will just throw himself at me with these big, big, big eyes and just say, "Mommy." And it's just unconditional love and happiness. And it's just at the beginning or an end of a long day, there's nothing like it. Wow. And then honorable mention goes to our dog, Shelby, who's just this like massive German shepherd who will also just kind of, similar to George, just jump on me,
with
a mess of fur, usually right before I'm going on camera somewhere.
Right. And so you just cover him.
But you know,
just covered in hair.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And just, it's all happiness.
Yeah.
And that gets me through the day.
That's so wonderful. I know I have a 3-year-old son myself. And
you get it.
Yesterday, he pretended to fart on my face and then turned around and said, "Mommy, you're so beautiful." And I was like, it's a roller coaster of emotions, kid, but I'm with you. I'm with you there. Yeah, well,
exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Alexandra.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
thank you.
You can follow Alexandra on Twitter at @A_Chandler, and you can donate and get involved with her campaign at alexandrachandler.com. So this was such a great conversation. I am looking forward to seeing you as a congresswoman.
Goodness, thank you. I enjoyed it too, very, very, very much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Hellions, that's it for me. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alexandra as much as I did. She was wonderful to talk to. She's so knowledgeable about national security, and her perspective on the Iran deal was just shocking to talk about, frankly. So don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Devin Candy, and you can follow Alexandra Chandler at @A_Chandler. And Drex and I will be back here on Monday with a great new show for you. Have a great weekend.